from the mind of a 2-foot-tall talking spokes puppet comes this year's biggest challenge. It's time for Bob's Dare to Compare, the hottest game show on TV that asks, what happens when you compare Bob's to the competition? You get style. You get quality. You get beeps and boops and dings and whomps. And thousands of dollars in savings. Everyone's a winner when you dare to compare with Bob's Discount Furniture. Shop in-store or at mybobs.com to play now.
For the first time, U.S. subscribers can stream MLB Network 24/7, including select out-of-market games.
Swing and a drive. It's deep. It's good. Yes!
Stream minor league affiliates.
Home run number one.
Or trap pick number one.
Plus, get MLB Big Inning and live audio for all 30 teams.
Baseball can't get better than this.
Experience the game like never before with MLB Network and At-Bat, your all-in-one baseball destination. Only $6.99 per month. Visit MLB.com/At-Bat for details. Blackout and other restrictions apply. MLB trademarks used with permission.
From 2400 Sports, Odyssey, and Major League Baseball, this is the PBP Voices of Baseball.
We bring you the people who bring you the game.
Hello, 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 and welcome in to the PBP Voices of Baseball, our final episode of the regular season. And for this one, we've got a doozy, just taped a couple of weeks ago with the great Bob Costas. You should not need his resume. You probably remember him from doing NBA finals for years with the Jordan Bulls and many others on NBC. NFL studio shows over there, Olympics studio shows, and the Major League Baseball Game of the Week for NBC in the 80s as the understudy for and the eventual partner with Vin Scully. There were lots of postseason series in the 90s. But I guess it's his place as a commentator on the state of baseball that cemented him in the zeitgeist as part of Ken Burns' baseball documentary series and much, much more. And he still does games, which we will discuss, including a postseason assignment this season upcoming. The big thing, though, the big takeaway that I want you to know is what a kind and generous and engaging man he is. The connection that we had in conversation was so easy and so fun. You'll hear it. And he didn't have to bother to try and really connect, you know? He stayed on after we finished our conversation for like 20 or 30 minutes afterwards, and we just talked about all sorts of stuff. At one point, we were discussing Barry Bonds and Clemens and A-Rod and Manny, and I told him I needed to take a break and call 1994 Matt Spiegel and tell him he was having a conversation with Bob Costas. And Bob said, well, I hope I lived up to it. And I said, are you kidding? You exceeded it. Before we get to Bob, stick around for the end of the show when I'll tell you about a very special playoff episode we have coming up for you next week. But now to Mr. Costas. Got a chance to tell him so many things about our shared love for baseball and went deep into Bob Costas' mind as a lover of the sport and, of course, of the craft. Enjoy. All right, I welcome a hero, a guest of great desire, and a legend, Bob Costas. Bob, I have questions.
Yes.
But I wanted to start with this because it can't be a coincidence that as your vast and varied broadcast career has progressively simplified itself by your own choosing, baseball mm-hmm. remains. So I assume that baseball play-by-play, which is what I'm investigating here, is one of the first broadcast loves for you as a kid in Queens. But I don't know. Is there an origin story of baseball play-by-play and your love specifically?
Yeah, I don't know that there's really an origin story. It just kind of seeped in. When I first became aware of sports, and for that matter of radio and television, baseball was still the unquestioned national pastime. Now, the Dodgers and Giants had just left for the West Coast, and the Mets didn't exist yet. But the Yankees were the best team in baseball year in and year out when I was a little kid. And their announcers were Mel Allen and Red Barber, their primary announcers. So while I had nothing to compare it to, I was hearing that kind of lyrical, well-paced soundtrack of baseball. And then, very briefly, just as it happened, we lived in Los Angeles in Southern California for a year and a half in the early 60s. And I listened to Vin Scully on a transistor radio. So basically, at that point, when I'm 10 years old, all I know of baseball broadcasting is Mel Allen, Red Barber, and Vin Scully. And then subsequently, every time I heard another broadcast, now there were exceptions. I soon became sophisticated enough to know that Ernie Harwell, who I'd listened to on WJR in Detroit, I'd go out to my father's car with the keys when I was much too young to drive and just turn it one click to the right. And then I would start fiddling with the dial and I'd pick up WJR in Detroit and Ernie Harwell and KDKA in Pittsburgh and Bob Prince. And sometimes on a very clear night, Harry Carey and Jack Buck on KMOX, where they were partners on the Cardinals games. And they were much different in their styles. And along came Lindsey Nelson and Bob Murphy with the Mets in 1962 with Ralph Kiner, who was endearing, but not because he was a classic baseball broadcaster. But having mentioned at the beginning of this ramble, Allen, Barber, and Scully, it became clear to me, even when I was like 12 years old, other than the few others I mentioned, it was a big drop off. There were others who were competent, but they didn't have that special sauce that turned a baseball broadcast into a melody. So that enchanted me when I was a kid.
Oh, understandably so. You know, it's interesting because Red and Mel, as two play-by-play guys who were partners, taking turns but also working together, still is the way that the Mets do it. With two play-by-play folks. Just last night, I was listening to John Miller and Dave Fleming doing the Giants game as Alex Cobb was trying to finish out that no-hitter. And I'm sitting on the balcony listening, and there's that timelessness listening to that.
I was watching it as it happened with Kruko and Kuiper on TV.
I mean, that's two great teams. That's both phenomenal broadcast teams right there. But I don't know how many ball clubs do the two play-by-play voices, both with that lyrical melodic sensibility as partners anymore. It's an old model. It doesn't exist too much anymore.
Not too much. I haven't done a complete survey. I can't say exactly to what extent, but I would say the majority are not like that. And the way it was done back then was, yeah, there were two guys or maybe even three. The Brooklyn Dodgers had Red Barber, Connie Desmond, and the young Vin Scully. But seldom were they really on the air simultaneously. One guy would have his innings, the other guy would have his innings, and Red Barber might say, and now to take you through the fourth and fifth, here's Vin Scully. And then Vin would, oh, thank you, Red. And maybe they talked to each other a little bit, but it wasn't like one's the play-by-play guy and one's the analyst. The whole idea of an analyst really didn't exist. They were classic play-by-play men. And even if they were former ball players who became play-by-play guys, like Wade Hoyt, the Yankee pitcher, who became the Cincinnati Reds broadcaster, they took the role of play-by-play man rather than analyst.
Mm-hmm. You know, there was a moment last night, your friend John Bugshambi gave me a lift home from Wrigley Field last night, and we're listening to John Miller call this game. And there's a moment where John Miller says, there's a foul ball off to the left over the moon. It's not full. It looks full. It'll be full tomorrow night. We both grinned and giggled. Right. Because he's such a master, it's just flowing into the description of, oh, there's the moon. I might as well describe that for people.
That detail is important. And of course, even a good radio broadcaster now has grown up with television. And they all have a monitor in the booth, which is useful, especially if there's a disputed play and you want to look at it again and you describe it. But apart from that, you should really, if you're on the radio, call a game as if you're talking to someone who doesn't own a television or is blind. That really is the way it should be done. And there is too much of an assumption because so much of television is seeped in. It's rare to hear a radio broadcaster, even an otherwise good one, describe a pitcher's delivery or a batter's stance. But what number does the guy wear? All those little things are taken for granted because of television.
What is it about the single voice and the hum of the baseball game and being
outside, whether it was listening to Ernie Harwell on a porch in Detroit, or me in Chicago listening to John Miller, or you in Queens listening to Mel and Red. What is it about the timelessness of that that connects us through the generations? I don't know.
Well, I think, first of all, baseball has the deepest and richest history of any sport, so there's more to call upon. Also, it has always had a pleasing leisurely pace. More recently, it had a plodding lethargic pace. They're trying to get back to the ideal pace, but it's never going to be a frenetic pace, nor should it be. And because it was always 154 or then 162 games, even though any individual game could be exciting, and in its own way, it's important as part of a pennant race, until you get down to the postseason or the last few days of playoff qualifying, none of these games seems like life and death. It's part of the spring and summer. And very often on the radio, people have it while they're doing other things. They're at the beach, they're in the car, they're in the backyard barbecuing, whatever they're doing. And the game is just kind of a presence in a different way than you would follow a once a week football game. Not just because of the time of the year, because it's fall and winter for football, but because that football game seems more essential. You know, it's once a week and it's your team. And basketball and hockey, which call upon a considerable amount of skill to call well, be it on television or on radio, it's still a different thing. I marveled at Doc Emrick, who was the only guy that I know of, that I don't have as deep a knowledge of hockey broadcasting as I might have of other sports, but I know a bit about it. There are a handful of guys that were as good as Doc at following the pace of play, the line changes, the passing of the puck, the sometimes frantic movement in hockey. But I couldn't think of anyone else who could drop in anecdotal material like he could. And I spoke with him about it, and that came from not only his innate broadcasting ability, but his love of baseball, which was really his first love. And all the great baseball announcers incorporated that. So he tried to whatever extent hockey allowed, which helped distinguish him from other hockey announcers. But where was I?
That's remarkable. I didn't know that about Doc. Hey, Doc has come up on this podcast and in these conversations because I've spent a lot of time thinking about verb choice for soft contact on the ground, hard contact on the ground, soft contact in the air, hard contact in the air, and gone through synonyms and written them down and tried to internalize them for the times that I've gotten a chance to do radio play by play. And no one in any sport may have ever been better than that than Doc Emrick. The verb choice is waffle-boarded, right? It's unbelievable.
He pitchforks it, which is such a vivid. Yeah, it was the guy with a pitchfork. He's going like that.
it gives you a lot. So growing up, you were my game of the week. You and Tony Kubek was my appointment Saturday viewing.
Well, there was also Vin and Joe at the same time. Can't slight them.
No, I would not. I would never. And then later, you and Vin, as you would host the games and hand off to Vin and occasionally fill in for Vin. So there was an interchangeable feeling to me as a young viewer.
Yeah, that was in the World Series or the LCS. Yeah.
Yes. But here you are still at this point, all these years later, still doing games on MLB Network and TBS. Will there be TBS this year or studio?
Yeah, I'll do one of the two National League Division Series for TBS with Ron Darling this October.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's great. A great play-by-play person has to be a technician and an entertainer both, and people come at this from different angles. Where would you say you started on that scale of technician, entertainer, and where are you now?
I think you have to start from the technician standpoint because you have to master the nuts and bolts. You also have to remember that while I did a handful, and I mean a handful of games on radio, filling in for Jack Buck on KMOX, and I did some minor league games when I was at Syracuse, it's probably less than a dozen. So almost everything I've done was not only on television, it's on network television. So as much regard as I have for the great radio announcers, and I may have been influenced by them, certainly I was, everything I've done has been essentially on television. But even there, you're looking to master the nuts and bolts of it first. Before you can deal in any flights of fancy and musings, you better get the ABCs down. I think everybody starts there. I think even Vin Scully probably started there. And then, but it didn't take him as long as it took most mortal men to get to a different place. But you still have to master the basics first. And then it becomes a blend. And I think what you listened to in the 1980s on the Game of the Week, and even in the 90s when NBC didn't have a regular season package, but we had the division series and the LCS with me and Bob Uecker and Joe Morgan, and then every other year the World Series, there was more of an understanding of the relationship in the booth on the part of the audience. Now, doing games on MLB, first of all, let's say if you're doing the Mets at the Cardinals, that game's not on in New York or St. Louis, you know, so people are less invested in it. And it's not the game of the week or the postseason game. So even if I have a great relationship with Tom Verducci or with Ron Darling, that can't be expressed and appreciated in quite the same way as Saturday after Saturday, year after year with Tony Kubek, or Vin with Joe Garagiola, or Ron Darling in a booth with Gary Cohen and Keith Hernandez, where not only have they been together for a long time and all the little quirks and asides and goofy stuff comes into play, but virtually everybody watching is a Met fan. And so they're feeling the same highs and lows, which is different than a national broadcast. You have to take into account all those things. So I think if I were a local broadcaster, which I thought that my biggest aspiration when I was at Syracuse University in my 20s was to be a local baseball broadcaster somewhere. And in my mind's eye, on the radio. And I think had I had that happened, then even more of a whimsical side would come out. It came out with Uecker. It came out with Kubek. It came out in different shows with Ahmad Rashad and studio shows. But it's just a different relationship on national TV as opposed to locally. My team, my voice of my team. That's a whole different deal. Harry Carey, especially the Harry Carey of the Cubs, not of the Cardinals, was a national treasure in the sense that with the superstation, some guy in Tacoma was eavesdropping on the Cubs broadcast, but it was still a 100% Cubs broadcast. And it was a 100% Harry broadcast. He wasn't doing it for a guy in New Hampshire or a guy in Sacramento. And so the guy in Sacramento who sought it out appreciated it on its own for its own merit. Whereas if someone had decided, hey, Harry, we're going to have you instead of Joe Buck do the World Series, some people would be delighted and others there'd be an insurrection. You know,
yeah,
because that just doesn't play by and large nationally. So this is a roundabout way of saying that I think that I had a discernible style that wasn't generic, and that went beyond the nuts and bolts and included observations not only about the game or how the weather was that day or look at this guy with the crazy face paint in the bleachers, or that was all there too. But I tended on national broadcasts where I thought appropriate to comment on the state of the game and issues surrounding the game, but never with the bases loaded in the ninth inning in a one run game. You know, you have to find your spots. But I tried to slip that in. So, you know, once I the bottom line would be once you've mastered the basics, then you can go wherever your specific sensibility takes you.
Mm-hmm. That makes all the sense in the world. A couple things there. I've talked with Joe Buck several times about this phenomenon, and now Joe Davis deals with it. And you'll deal with it in the playoffs and do it on TBS. That you're with this companion sport that the fans yes. are with their local people all year long. Mm-hmm. And you forge this incredible connection and you go on the journey right. then you're deposited to national voices.
Yes.
And often in your role and Joe's role, you are loathed by both fan bases equally and assumed that a bias is there equally.
Right.
And it's what a potentially tormenting spot for a human being to be in.
This is as old as network baseball on television itself. And you get much less of it with football, because even though football has local radio broadcasters in the NFL, every game is a network game. So there's not as much of an attachment. And basketball or hockey are different from baseball. So I've said this for a long time. As long as the technology allows it, why not do the equivalent of a Manning cast or a K-Rod cast? So let's say last year it's the Guardians and the Yankees, or on Darling and I did on TBS. Let's say you want to hear Tom Hamilton, the terrific voice of the Guardians, even though he's their radio voice, he's their primary guy. So they'd move him over in this experiment that I'm talking about. Why not just have a parallel telecast? They have to show the same commercials, because you have to protect the very large rights fee investment of the network. They have to show the same commercials. They can't show the local commercials. And they get one dedicated camera, but basically they're relying on whatever the TBS or the Fox people are putting out. And that might be a little bit off center from what they're talking about at any given time, but they'd adjust to it. And the point would be that if you want to hear Tom Hamilton, you should hear Tom Hamilton, because that's the way your team sounds. And then some people might go back and forth, but they would have that option. And as long as there was a way, and the technology is there, to protect the investment of the network, it might actually increase their ratings. Because some people might say, oh, I get my guy, or no, I can go over here and see what Costas is saying, or whatever. But to the other question about they hate both sides, the guy in Cleveland doesn't think I hate the Yankees. And the guy in New York doesn't think I hate the Guardians. They only think you hate their team. And I've answered this question before, Matt. And maybe you've heard me give these exact same examples. I don't think any network broadcaster has ever received a letter back when people wrote letters, or an email to the effect of, dear Mr. Buck, Costas, Davis, whatever. I live in Tacoma and I'm a fan of the Seattle Mariners. Hence, I had no rooting interest in the World Series between the Phillies and the Astros, other than the fact that I'm a baseball fan. And yet I was appalled by your obvious bias toward the Astros or the Phillies. That no one has ever received one communication to that effect. But they have received virtually the identical letter from fans of both teams watching the same broadcast, hearing the exact same words, and interpreting those words as bias against their team, including in supposedly sophisticated markets like New York and San Francisco, because we know that fan is short for fanatic. And even intelligent, otherwise rational people throw that out the window when it comes to their team, where their definition of objectivity is to root as crazily for their team, which is their right, enjoy it as they are, to see it through the prism of their fandom. So in that world, understandably, their team loses, the other team doesn't win. Their team wins, the other team doesn't lose. There is no other fan base that they're concerned about. So if you show appreciation, as you should, for both teams, then that sounds different than their local broadcast is likely to sound. And so there are some criticisms or observations that a fair-minded person does take into account. But this one falls into the category of a sort of benign lunacy. I get it. I'm not offended by it. But
yes,
I'm telling you, there is not a scintilla's worth of truth in any of it. It is completely stupid. And I'm going to give you one last example. Vin Scully.
Okay.
Vin Scully, the paragon of professionalism, is doing the 1986 World Series, one of the most famous World Series, the Red Sox and the Yankees, with Joe Garagiola. and this is before Twitter existed or anything else, but people would call a station with a complaint. And the NBC station in Boston logged some 800 complaints that Vin and Joe were unfair to the Red Sox. Simultaneously on the same night, 1,000 complaints in New York, roughly, is around figures, 1,000 complaints to WNBC in New York or to NBC headquarters in New York, complaining about the exact opposite. They're unfair to the Mets. I attribute the difference to the larger population of New York and the fact that back then there was such a thing as a toll call. So it would cost you to call from Boston or Vermont or whatever was part of Red Sox territory. But the point was that people in sophisticated cities where they read the Boston Globe and the New York Times were convinced that Vin Scully was was dumping on their team with the same words on the same night.
This is what I told Joe. You've read or seen 1984, Orwell's 1984, right? As the working force is going through its day, they make them pause and look up and show them the enemy, give them something to hate. They call it the 2 minutes hate. And everyone looks at the screen and shrieks and throws all their anger there. And then they go back to work. This is your job, is to just accept the hate and the venom as people work their feelings through. This is part of the joy and the folly of sports.
Yes, there are some criticisms, including self-criticisms, that you should take quite seriously. This is one that you should just laugh at and dismiss.
I wanted to circle back, Bob, to the idea of the entertainer and the technician. The premise for this podcast and my personal fascination with the craft and the job is that I'm a talk show host and I've been a writer and a voiceover guy and a singer and a million other things for decades and decades. And at age 50, I got my chance to do my first inning of Major League Baseball.
How did it go?
Pre-post in the fifth for the, great. Pre-post in fifth for the Cubs. I did 3 years, 12 innings total over 3 years. And then this year, I got the chance to do three games in full when Pat Hughes went into the Hall of Fame and got the Fritzy Frick Award. So I did Cubs Cardinals for three full games. It was the first three of their 8-game win streak. But I am an entertainer who has come at it completely green at the beginning of 3 years ago from the technical perspective. And it's been fascinating. I have a nephew's a AAA broadcaster. So I know you have to have the technician part first, but sometimes that's not the way it can go. So that's kind of the idea for how we end up talking about it with some of the depth I'm trying to get to.
Yeah. Well, somebody, you know, in these days, a two-man radio booth is different than what I described in the 50s and 60s. You know, Vin Scully adhered to that model. That was the model. And so he took that forward when he did radio for the Dodgers. Jerry Doggett was at his side. And he'd say, well, here's Jerry Doggett. Thank you, Jerry. And then he would just do what he did. And then on television, he worked alone. But he was the last of those doing that. On radio now, you'll usually hear two voices. The play-by-play guy is the dominant voice, but it's not like the other guy isn't there at all. And the other guy is almost always a former player and therefore a color man or analyst. But to your point, somebody's got to drive the bus. You know, someone else can be the conversationalist in the passenger seat, but somebody's got to drive the bus. And some of that is just getting you from point A to point B. And that is the duty of the play-by-play man, no matter how colorful that play-by-play man's personality might be.
You're right. And broadcasting is broadcasting in some of that regards. I know how to come in and out of break, and I know how to do the live reads and slide that in and set people up. But obviously, history is littered with former ball players who learned to be play-by-play technicians. Yeah. So it can happen, right? Euchre, Brantley right now does several innings. I mean, there's a million, obviously.
Euchre's probably the best of them because it's amazing. At 89 going on 90, he sounds almost exactly the same as he did 20 years ago. But you didn't know, if you took out all the great Mr. Baseball comedy and you didn't know of the futility of his career and you just listened to his calls, they're terrific. I mean,
you'd have no idea.
He could get he could have gotten the Frick Award just on the basis of his pure play-by-play and leave the persona aside. But of course, when you combine it with the persona, then you got a baseball treasure.
Bob, the perch where you sit above the game with that perfect view, being able to see the whole field, is special. And I wondered if there's what's something that you can see from that spot when you work that fans would learn a lot about the game from if they were able to sit there and watch from there.
Well, you know, there are some ballparks, especially now, where there are sky boxes and all the revenue producing things, and eventually the broadcast booth gets put like at the top of a wedding cake. The worst, in my experience, and I haven't broadcast games in all 30 present major league parks, but of the ones that I've done games from, a National Stadium in D.C., the pitch is so extreme that when you first do a game there, you think that every routine fly ball is going out of the park. It's almost impossible to judge. The same thing was true when they wedding caked Fenway Park, because there was no other way to do it. And then you had to get used to it, because Fenway and Tiger Stadium used to be the booths that were closest to the field. You really felt like you were in the game. If the crowd was quiet between innings, you could almost hear conversations from down on the field. And Ernie Harwell eventually had to put a net up in front of him as he got a little bit older and his reflexes dulled a little bit, because foul balls would come straight back so quickly into that booth because they weren't coming at the same arc. They'd come back like five or six a game. Now maybe five or six a season might find its way into a way up their broadcast booth. So what was my point? I had a point. What could I say?
You were talking about how the perch changes from place to place. And you're right, because I can read stuff well from Wrigley now, but you're right. Fenway or the Nationals is legendarily bad. So question was, what can you learn about the game? Like watching the fielders or watching the ball? But what you're saying is like learning how to read the ball off the bat is supposed to be what you get great at in that spot.
Yeah. And it's a little more or less difficult depending upon the angle and the relationship to the field. But what you can see that the person in the stands or at home can't see. You simultaneously see the entire field with the naked eye, but you've also got the monitor there, which isn't just showing you program. You have an ISO camera. So that's searching around for interesting stuff. Who's in the bullpen? Here's a possible shot we might go to of a kid with an ice cream cone smeared all over his face. Here's the manager in the dugout. Plus you've got your stat guy and whatever preparation you've brought to it. So you're in a different state of mind. Nobody, I mean, even an avid fan sitting right behind home plate or watching on television, really into the game, concentrates on every pitch. But you have to when you're calling the game. And 3 hours of concentration, even with quicker games now, you figure the coming on, getting off, 3 hours roughly, is not the usual thing. No, people don't do that in the office. 3 hours of you do get 2 minutes maybe in between. But what I've taken to doing, unless I look and I see it's my wife or one of my kids, people text you during a game, right? This didn't happen a generation ago. They text you during the game and they say, hey, that was a great catch. Or you think they should take this guy out now? Hey, you're sitting on your ass. I'm working. Don't you understand that? I actually had a guy I went to high school with. I swear. I'm doing the game. It's in Philadelphia. It's like 5 years ago. And I get a text from this guy. And this is what he says. Curious, Clint. When you do a game in Philly, do you take Amtrak or do you drive back to New York? I'll get around to responding to this, not immediately after the game, maybe in a week when I have nothing else to do. Okay. So ideally these 2 minutes, maybe you don't have to concentrate as intensely, but that's when you take stock. You know, what haven't we gotten to? Let me check on this. Maybe this is when you slurp a, you know, a bit of coffee or whatever it is.
But there's a forced mindfulness to actually doing the job, which is a beautiful thing. We don't do it much in our lives. Turning off the phone for 3 hours is a rarity, and it's a joy when you're doing a game.
Correct, because you're locked into that. But the other thing that you can see in from the booth under normal circumstances that even the most observant fan can't, if he or she's watching on television, is a ball hit into the gap. Where is everybody? Because your eyes are going to be flashing between the field and the monitor. You want to know, and I always position the monitor so I don't have to turn my head. I have it like this way, so I barely have to move my eyes to see both that and the field. And a great director will capture what's happening. But what you don't realize, because you're watching on television, you don't realize that the announcer, okay, now the ball's against the wall. Who's the runner? How fast is he? He's rounding second. What's the third base coach doing? How many outs are there? Two outs are going to send him, one out maybe going to stop him. Who's on deck? Right? Who's on deck? So that would affect it. What's the score of the game? That would affect it. What's the third base coach doing? What's the relay guy doing? You know, where's he looking? Is he looking to the plate or is he going to try to get the trail runner at third? Now, this will be well cut by the director, but you're seeing all this in real time and your call reflects it. Not so much necessarily in a transcript, maybe, but especially in the tone of voice, because you're anticipating. Is a guy going to score easily? All right, you're not going to get up to a fever pitch. Is it going to be a close play? You know, and then you begin to anticipate that. So what was lost, and I'm sure the other announcers you've talked to have mentioned this, when guys were doing games remotely, most were skillful enough to do a good job. But that was what was missing. You were reliant on, basically, you were seeing and calling exactly what the person at home was seeing. You didn't have the advantage of that broader view. And it did lead to some either missed calls or hesitant calls that weren't as present and weren't as exciting as if the guy had been in the booth.
Oh, absolutely. It was disastrous, but not as disastrous as I'd feared, because I thought maybe some teams would pinch the pennies and never go back to it. And a couple of them were slow and straggling, but I think everybody is back. Boy, the description of like a play at the plate with a relay, maybe it's a double in the gap, was beautiful, because that is the stuff that I think is so special to be able to see from that perspective. It's funny, the play this week where Ellie De La Cruz throws out Corbin Carroll at the plate as he's trying to stretch a triple to an inside the park home run. And everybody I've talked about that play with this week is like, oh, can you believe it? Just that, because it has everything. That those are the best plays in the game. Those are better than home runs to me. There's that much going on, and it's a long time you get to talk when you're describing a play like that.
And that play had something about it that reminded me of Bo Jackson throwing Harold Reynolds out at the plate. It wasn't just a great play. It was a play that reordered the base runner's understanding of what was possible. Like, Harold Reynolds was so stunned, I can't be out on this play. Well, Bo Jackson was freakishly talented and athletic. He made a throw that Harold Reynolds, a very fast runner, an experienced player, could not have anticipated. And we know that Ellie De La Cruz throws as fast as most elite pitchers. I mean, his throws have been measured at 97, 98 miles an hour. So
that one was at 99.7. Was it 99.7? That throw on that play.
So that's probably his highest measured velocity to this point. And, you know, a base runner and even a third base coach has an intuitive sense of all these things. You know, what can we expect here? He might gamble. It's not going to be a perfect throw. It's not going to be right on the plate. So I'm going to be safe unless it's perfect and the tag is perfect. I'm going to be safe. But what Carroll, who's one of the fastest runners in baseball, did not take into account is that now the relay is coming from a guy who throws harder than anybody else. I've never experienced this before. So he'll be forewarned the next time.
Yes, absolutely. Bob, is there a specific item when you're doing a baseball game that you like to have with you in the booth? Could be a good luck charm, a talisman, or anything that you absolutely need to do the game that is unique to you.
Well, my only thing, and I have it with me almost all the time. I don't happen to have it on me right now, but I have my 1958 Mickey Mantle baseball card that I always have in my jacket pocket when I'm calling a game. But by the same token, if I go out to dinner, I have it. I went to the dinner last night, I had it with me. There's always an off chance. Now, I'm not really a superstitious sort, but there's an off chance. It still happens. People will ask me, strangers, do you have that Mantle card? And I don't want to disappoint them. And when I do produce it, they're delighted. Like 50, 60-year-old people, they're delighted to see it. So I don't want to disappoint them. So especially for a baseball broadcast, I would feel naked if I went into a booth to call a game and didn't have the 58 Mantle with me. Now, a more practical thing is I always take binoculars with me because there are times when you want to see something up close that the truck is not going to give you. You just want to examine something a little bit more closely. Sometimes it's between innings, like what's going on in the dugout. Now, you can alert the truck to that and they might find it for you. But sometimes you just take your own initiative.
My I wonder about scoring. Just had Bob Carpenter on a previous episode, and I use his book, as do so many. Also, Marty Brenneman's answer to that question was the number one pencil. He used to use the number one pencil only, and he couldn't get it anywhere, so he ended up buying it by the case. And I had never known the number one pencil existed. But what have you used to score with, and has that evolved through the years for you?
I luckily was right here under this desk. Now, this is my advantage as a guy who did the game of the week in the 80s and only All-Star games and postseason in the 90s, and now just the occasional game for MLB Network. So the only time I'm doing consecutive games, essentially, is in the postseason. And it's never more than five in the division series. So I can do this, whereas the guys doing 162, almost all of them have a notebook. So they can go back to yesterday's game or the last time these two teams met. And didn't that guy throw tight on this guy? And that's why this guy's glaring at him this time. There's a backstory. So they couldn't do this. This is my scorecard. Can you see it?
I can pull it back a little bit towards you. Yeah.
You see it, or is
that
blurred?
I got it. Is that hand created by you? What is that?
It was created by a graphic artist friend of mine in St. Louis in the 80s when I started doing the game of the week on NBC. And the point of it is that while I might have index cards and other notes, I'm getting as much as humanly possible onto this giant scorecard so that the spaces to put in the names on the lineup are bigger. The spaces for notations for 6-3 or, you know, a triple or whatever it is are bigger so that I can put in, it was a 3-1 pitch, it was a slider. I can put stats in. The defense is up here. The pitching changes are over here. But then there's this whole side on both sides, just flip it over, depending on which team is at bat, for other notes so that I'm not doing this all the time.
Yeah.
I guess on a podcast, people don't realize what I'm doing. I'm turning my head from side to side.
No.
Most of it is right in front of me so that I don't have to search as much. And then once I've made all these notes, some of it I transfer because you don't know, you're working the night before, you don't know what the lineup's going to be exactly. So then you transfer some of it over to the little slot where the number two hitter is or the number eight hitter is. There's even a space at the bottom for the bench, and you put left, right, switch, so you know what the bench is. And then And this is an advantage that the local announcer doesn't have, because I'm just doing that one game. And even if I'm doing a postseason series, it's always the same two teams. But I look it over so that I've essentially memorized it, or I'm familiar with it, so that when I glance at it, I'm not reading it again. It's a reminder. It's a reminder of something mm-hmm. I've already internalized. This works very well for me. I don't think it would be practical for somebody who's doing a game day in, day out.
It's a beautiful visual, though. I'm glad you showed it to me, having all that extra space and then the flip over to have the other team on the other side. I haven't talked to anybody who does that. You designed it that way. You knew exactly what you needed, and had a friend tweak it the way that it works best for you.
That's right. And one time it was a playoff game, like 2013, 2014, Cardinals and Dodgers. Back then, MLBN had two games in the playoffs each year, one in the National League and one in the American League. So I'm doing the game at Dodger Stadium, and I did get distracted, which you shouldn't do. You know, maybe the producer's saying, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. And I didn't flip the card over. So the Dodgers were in the field, and I start saying, well, so coming up, and I forget who it was, might have been Austin Barnes or somebody, whoever was catching for the Dodgers. And it took me like two pitches to realize, you moron, the Cardinals are at bat. You're going to flip the damn thing over. So then I made a joke out of it. Well, perhaps it would be advisable to flip this card over. Al Michaels called me. He got a kick out of it.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Well, you know, I mean, people mess up. I mean, I'm with Boog last night. We're listening to Miller, and Miller got caught doing something. He started a sentence he couldn't quite finish, but he's so artful that I'm sure nobody noticed other than maybe Boog, who had to alert me to it. It happens all the time.
Well, you know, if you're skillful, you can turn a bobble. It's almost like a shortstop bobbles the ball. Doesn't mean he can't get the out. He hasn't completely booed.
Jazz.
Or it's jazz. You just riff. But also,
yes, it's like you make the mistake once, it's a mistake. Do it twice, it's jazz. See, I leaned into it like that.
Yeah, you got to lean into it. You know, Johnny Carson used to do that all the time. If a joke bombed, it became funnier than if the joke had connected. But that's partially a product of having the trust of the audience. If the audience already likes you and accepts you, then a misstatement or some kind of awkward moment, they forgive you for it, and they may even embrace it. You know, Vin Scully didn't make many mistakes. And even when he did make a mistake, his way of getting out of it was so artful. This must have happened 15 years ago. I don't remember the exact circumstances, except the bases might have been loaded and it was an extra base hit and guys are running everywhere. And he had the wrong guy arriving at third base. And, you know, he's doing the game by himself, so he can't, you know, bounce it off somebody else. And so when he realizes that it's wrong and he sets it straight, then he goes, easy, Scully, easy. Like he's talking to himself. He's gonna like slow down, easy Scully, easy, or he's channeling Red Barber from 1952, giving the young Scully, you know, some advice.
Wow, and you know that at that moment, all the Dodger fans are like, "You got this, Vin. That's all right.
That's right.
You got this, buddy."
Yeah. That's right.
Oh God. All right. Tell me a moment that you loved in the booth that we ought to go pull and listen to. First thing that comes to your mind that you're comfortable everyone hearing, assuming that we can find it.
You know, this one probably is known to some of your listeners, and I didn't expect the questions just popped in my head. It's maybe not the best example, but 1995 Division Series, Red Sox at Indians, as they were then known. Game goes 15 innings. There's some rain, and Tony Pena, on a 3-0 pitch, homers to win it. And I was so surprised by it. The call is accurate, but it also reflected the kind of surprise that someone in the stadium would feel.
I've never had that opportunity.
When you were active, your managers weren't that desperate.
That's what I'm saying. When I was active, oh man! Pena on 3-0 sends everybody home. Tony Pena spells goodnight against his old teammates, sitting on a 3-0 pitch, and this team that won 27 games in its final at-bat, that had 48 come-from-behind wins, that was 13-0 in extra inning games, did all those things when Tony Pena connected.
Euchre was talking about something, saying some funny thing, because no one anticipated that he'd swing at the 3-0 pitch. So I had to jump over him a little bit, but it worked out okay.
That's that's nice, because if you remember it, because it was honest. And you know, it represented what the fans were probably feeling and thinking.
Yeah, it was honest, but it was also professionally accurate. You know, if it was just a gut reaction and it missed the dotting of the I's and the crossing of the T's, I wouldn't be so happy about it. And it's been called to my attention years later, because apparently it's on YouTube. So people have told me that they've seen it.
Wow, that's really cool. If I were to ask you about the Marlins walk off to win a World Series, I mean, it doesn't get much bigger as moments go than that. What did it feel like in that moment for you?
You know, it's a national broadcast, so you know that, and it's important who's the home team. And this is something that fans should realize and often don't. Well, he sounded more excited when such and such happened than when such and such happened. That's a natural thing. You've got the headset on. You're hearing the mix of crowd sound. You're going to have to raise your voice without even thinking about it to get above the tumult of a home crowd. And you don't have to have the same reaction if there's a hush. Sometimes a guy could do something great in a baseball game for the visiting team. You might as well be overlooking the 18th green at Augusta. But a single in the fourth inning in a postseason game in front of a raucous crowd might seem more exciting. So there's that element to it. As it happened, the Marlins were the home team. So when the game went to the ninth, or bottom of the ninth, or extra innings, obviously only the Marlins could win it in walk-off fashion. And if the Marlins won, there was going to be uproarious cheering. If Cleveland had won, I was going to be appreciative, but I wouldn't have to get up over the crowd to do it. When the Indians took a one-run lead to the ninth, I tried to set it up by saying, there are people in South Florida who have waited 5 years for this, because that's all the franchise that existed. There are people in Cleveland who have never seen it or have waited since 1948. So in a sense, and I was anticipating, A, to frame it, but B, to give them their due in a way that the crowd would not. So in a sense, for those fans, this wouldn't just be for the present day Indians who have rampaged through the American League in the 90s. It would be for those who remember Max Alvis and Sudden Sam McDowell or Larry Doby or whatever it might be. So I tried to give them their due in a quiet moment when nothing was happening. Now, as I look back on that call, Craig Counsell was the runner at third base. Right before the last pitch, I think the second to last pitch, I said,
so now it's Counsell who carries the run that could win the World Series as he leads away from third. Renteria bats with two out, and a breaking ball is in there.
And then Edgar Renteria singled off Charles Nagy's glove.
The 0-1 pitch. A liner off Nagy's glove into center field. The Florida Marlins have won the World Series.
And I said, a liner off Nagy's glove into center field. You see the cut from the director changes to Counsell running home. And I say, the Florida Marlins have won the World Series. In retrospect, the reason I didn't say here comes Counsell with the run that means was that I just said it. So that was my mindset at the time. But now, as that is replayed a gazillion times, it would have been better in isolation to say, here comes Counsell with the run that means the Florida Marlins have won the World Series, because he raised his arms in exultation. So the current announcer has to think in a way that old-time announcers didn't. this is going to not only be replayed on highlight shows that night, but it might be in documentaries and appreciations years and years from now. And they're not going to care about everything that was said in a 3-hour broadcast. They're going to care about that moment. So I actually wish that I had said, here comes counsel. But I had just said, just prior to that, counsel leads away with the run that could mean the World Series. So it didn't occur to me to say it that way in real time.
The snippetizing of our culture, removing context. I like that you didn't say it because you're thinking like a broadcaster. You're trying not to double up. Yes.
That's right.
Just a couple more minutes. I appreciate your generosity with the time. I've told Ryan Sandberg this, that the Sandberg game, I liken it to when Elton John came just after he had recorded and released his debut album. He played some legendary shows at the Troubadour in Los Angeles, and everyone was there. And he says that changed everything. He just blew up onto the scene. And that is the equivalent for Ryan Sandberg on the National. Like, I feel like that game won him the MVP. Like, that game set him up for the profile that he maintained the rest of the way. Did you feel the largesse of that either after the game or since? Have you felt the largesse of that for him?
Since, absolutely. It's the signature game of a Hall of Fame career. He might well have been the MVP anyway, and that was only late June. But that set him up in the national mind as the front runner for the Hall of Fame. And it drove the point home that the long woebegone Cubs might actually be a contending team. So I recognized that shortly thereafter. And obviously now, all these years later, Sandberg himself says that it's the central moment of his career.
Coordinating producer of baseball, Harry Coyle. 1-1 pitch.
Doing the game itself, I was just reveling in how classic it was. Saturday afternoon, there weren't lights at Wrigley Field until 5 years later, so they were all afternoon games. But this was a Saturday afternoon game of the week. And you had to understand what the game of the week meant then. It wasn't just one of a jumble of games that are everywhere now. If you lived in a non-major league city, you didn't mow the lawn during that portion of the afternoon. You know, you live in Pensacola. This is your one opportunity to see Fernando Valenzuela face Johnny Bench or whatever it might have been, or Ron Guidry try to get Carl Yastrzemski out. So you knew that it was a giant audience. Plus, it was Cardinals Cubs. It made a difference that it was the Cardinals. You see a lot of red in the stands at Wrigley. You see a lot of blue in the stands at Busch Stadium. There were central characters involved who were vivid. Whitey Herzog, Willie McGee, Ozzie Smith, and they all put an imprint on the game. Bruce Sutter was bound for the Hall of Fame. By acclamation, the best reliever in the game. Relievers were used differently then. He came in the 7th and was still pitching in the 10th. He gave up both last-ditch home runs to Sandberg. So you had a setting, and the television aspect was different, and the two teams. And then what unfolded was so improbable and so dramatic and so theatrical. And the movie The Natural had come out that spring. And so it occurred to me to say, we might be looking at the real Roy Hobbs, because this is almost too theatrical to be true. That's what I was thinking of in the moment. And it was only somewhat afterwards and continuing to this day that I realized how important it is to the history of the Cubs and to Ryan Sandberg's personal history. So much so, you're in Chicago, you probably know this, there have been at least 3 documentaries done about that game. Not just about the Cubs, which is a rich subject, but about that game. And on that date, every year, somebody calls me, usually from Chicago, to be on and talk about that game. And it's the only regular season game, other than the George Brett Pine Tar game. It's a regular season game that has a name, the Sandberg game. And Matt, I swear, it doesn't happen nearly as much. But for a long time, if I was in Chicago, I could be walking down the street and a cab driver might yell from the window, "Bob, the Sandberg game." That's all he'd say. Is that like, yeah, I know. It's a code. And he wasn't so much applauding me as he was seeing me reminded him of a shared memory. So we were the same in that moment. You know, we both experienced it. We both remember it. You give the guy a thumbs up.
It's so beautiful. All right. Bob Costas, want to close by asking for the best piece of advice that you ever got, or it could be something now you'd like to give, but I want to ask for it in two parts. One would be mechanically for actually doing the job of play-by-play. Mm-hmm. And then the second part would be overall in terms of having a successful career. And as I ask this to you, I can't think of anybody who's had a more interesting and varied and compelling broadcasting career that I'll ever have a chance to talk to. So it gives a little added weight. No pressure. So first bit of advice is mechanically for doing the gig of play-by-play.
You know, Marty Glickman, who was the first of the long parade of sportscasters to come out of Syracuse University, and really the first athlete. He was on the 1936 Olympic team with Jesse Owens, and he played basketball and football at Syracuse. The first jock turned broadcaster and became a first-rate Hall of Fame level play-by-play announcer. And toward the end of his career, NBC hired him as their sportscasting coach. And he would make observations more to a youngster like me and fewer to someone like Dick Enberg. But even with Enberg, you might have an observation respectfully submitted. And so this is in the early 80s. And he says, "Look, how old are you?" "I'm 30. "You look like you're 15. You have to combat that. A mature person seldom talks rapidly unless he has to, like on a fast break in basketball. Slow down. Don't talk as rapidly. Let what you say sink in. It will counter the notion that you're, as he put it, a bright and well-informed kid, but still a kid. You have to work against that." And I don't know that I ever fully conquered the appearance part, but I did take his advice in terms of delivery. And I became, I think, not measured to the point of being plodding, but a better pace.
Yeah, I think it added gravitas right away. Added a sense of
that's right.
That's beautiful.
Exactly. I happen to see out of nowhere, you know, when YouTube intuits your interests, you know, I get every Rodney Dangerfield bit on the Johnny Carson show. I get all the 60s and 70s music I love, and I get a lot of sports stuff. So this thing pops up from 1982. It's like some regional NFL game, the Colts again, I get who. And I'm thinking, what is this? I'm going to watch like 60 seconds of it. It's me not with Bob Trumpy. I wasn't with Bob Trumpy yet. I was with Gene Washington, the 49ers receiver. And I am so prepared, but I'm rattling this stuff off. Like there's no space. You know, I'm trying to prove myself. And it's like, my God. You sound like you need to take I'm thinking,
that's what Marty Glickman was watching.
How did they ever stick with me?
Yeah. That's what Glickman saw right there.
Yeah, that's what Glickman saw, and he helped me correct.
And then in terms of an overall career, and this could be anything, just, you know, somebody who wants to broadcast and make content for their lives.
Just in this conversation and what I know of you, you've followed this advice, or maybe it's just the way your life has turned out, so it fits this bit of advice. Be as well-rounded a person as you can be. Read as much as you can. Avail yourself not only of other broadcasters whom you admire, which is important, but avail yourself of the world. You know, when you read and you come across something that clicks with you, you're not going to plagiarize it, but it broadens your understanding of the use of language, the way language can effectively be used. You know, no one should copy Vin Scully, and those who did only sound like pale imitations of the master. But what I got from Vin Scully was the idea of pacing, the idea that anecdotes can be worked in. Now, Vin had a unique advantage beyond his incredible talent, and that was that he was working alone, and the way Dodger games were directed was from the inside out. The picture was never imposed on him. They always followed him. So we had the canvas to do what he did uniquely well. So you can never replicate either his talent or his circumstances, but you can still take something from it. You're not copying. You're saying that's a thing. How does that work for me? Jack Buck had a great dry wit. He was a terrific banquet MC, and he would just throw in these sly asides on Cardinal broadcasts. Now, I'm not going to make the same type of joke Jack Buck made. He came from a different generation, but he did it effectively. That emboldened me to do the same thing. And this seems like it's from left field, but a real turning point for me, because I think you were implying that the Sandberg game was as much a turning point for me as for Sandberg, and it was important for me. But the single most important for me, important early thing for me in my television career was David Letterman. When I went on David Letterman the first time in 1982 to call elevator races, and they weren't looking for me, you know, it was one of these mock things, and I knew exactly what he wanted. He wanted it to sound like it came from Mount Olympus, straight face, mock serious elevator races. But he was looking for Marv Albert, and Marv was out of town calling a basketball game. All right, so send Don Crick. He's not here. We got a kid here. We're taping in an hour. Send him up. So I go to the sixth floor. He had no idea who I was. He actually introduced me as Bob Costa, left the S off. But I was a fan of Letterman. I knew exactly what he wanted, and it got big laughs, so much so that he invited me back to sit on the set with him at the end of the show. And then he brought me back for subsequent stunts, but then also as a guest. Now, how does that tie in? Prior to that, Don Olmeyer, who ran NBC Sports, I was playing golf with him in Hawaii. He assigned me to the Hula Bowl. And he said to me as we're playing golf, you know, you're telling me all these stories, you're really funny. If you never get any better than you are now, you'll be good. But if you can incorporate this personality that I'm seeing here, that's when you'll go to the next level. And the reason I couldn't at that point was I was so concerned with, not only am I a newcomer, I look like a kid. I'm so concerned with proving that I have the broadcasting chops, that it might have been technically excellent, but it lacked all the touches that I hope I was able to bring to bear. I had that in St. Louis because the audience knew me, and I was on non-sports shows in St. Louis that had comedic elements to it, but I was uptight at NBC. So I listened to what Olmeyer said, but I hadn't acted upon it yet. But when I got the reaction, not only from the audience, but from Letterman himself, that emboldened me. And I became what I hope is true. You know, it's one of my favorite things that's ever been said about me, and I hope it's true. He's reverent and irreverent at the same time. Oh. It's like, if you could put that on my tombstone, I'd be delighted. I'd be happy to die tomorrow if they guaranteed they would put that on my tombstone. Because I think at my best, that was the idea. But at the beginning, I had the reverence, but not the irreverence. And eventually I was able to blend them.
That is a perfect place to finish. I love that. Thank you, Bob Costas. What a great pleasure.
Thank you very much, Matt. It was a pleasure to do it.
Perfect. The reverent and irreverent Bob Costas, everybody. On the key question of this whole podcast, his answer was fascinating, right? Once you master the basics and the mechanics, then you can go wherever your sensibilities take you. Bob's sensibilities are vast, as is his knowledge and curiosity. It makes complete sense that he was a great technician first, successful and mature beyond his years, then eventually had his personality confirmed and encouraged by Don Ohlmeyer and by David Letterman. It makes me realize, frankly, how I grew up wanting to display the sensibilities and the gravitas of Bob Costas. And then, just lately, in terms of play-by-play, I've had to catch up frantically on the mechanics and the technical aspects. But anyway, I remain committed to this particular way to skin a cat, because it's the only cat I have available. Before we get to the credits, you will see more PBP episodes in your feed. Next week, a playoff episode. Going to be so cool. Joe Buck is going to join us, and we are going to go over the greatest calls in baseball's postseason history, as selected by all the guests of the podcast this year. Reached out to everybody. Dave Sims, John Miller, Marty Brenneman, Dan Shulman, everybody, and got submissions for what they think are the greatest postseason calls of all time. And Joe Buck and I will listen through them and talk through them with you. Can't wait. My producer on the PBP Voices of Baseball is the great Ryan Porth. My collaborator is James Vickery. The theme music comes from the great Kurt Morrison of Tributosaurus. Find the PBP Voices of Baseball on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts from 2400 Sports, Odyssey, and Major League Baseball. The PBP Voices of Baseball. I'll bring you the people who bring you the game.
From the mind of a 2-foot-tall talking spokes puppet comes this year's biggest challenge. It's time for Bob's Dare to Compare. The hottest game show on TV that asks, what happens when you compare Bob's to the competition? You get style. You get quality. You get beeps and boops and dings and whomps. And thousands of dollars in savings. Everyone's a winner when you dare to compare with Bob's Discount Furniture. Shop in store or at mybobs.com to play now.
Trying to figure out what to eat for dinner yet again? With Knorr Sides and Bouillon as your not-so-secret ingredient, you can skip the drive-thru and do dinner at home. Knorr Taste Combos provide a menu of delicious, affordable, and well-balanced meals that you can prepare in 30 minutes or less. Visit Knorr.com to get quick and easy recipe ideas for your home-cooked weeknight dinners. It's not fast food, but it's so good.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
It's a good thing baseballs already have stitches. Because the way these ball players are hitting them... Yeah, they need stitches if they didn't already have them. So the next time you're watching a poor little baseball smacked off the wall in center, keep that little fella in your thoughts. It's hard to be a baseball right now. Baseball is something else. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.